Hi, welcome to this week's program. It's our 18th year of broadcasting, and it's time to take a moment to reflect on things just a little. On September 4th, 2001, exactly 1 week before 9/11, we began broadcasting. Needless to say, it took many months to get on our feet, especially because of the historic event, but also because, while I had an idea of what I wanted to say and do, I had no experience in media at all. Luckily, I had a helper, Daryl Lagulo, who co-hosted the program for 2 years, acting as the virtual anchor who helped shape my ideas into what it eventually became and what the show is currently doing today. Jerry Carr, the general manager of WXCL, took a chance with us, and Joanna Marie, the program director, kept us totally on track. Also, Ross and Wendy Cooper guided me and made sure I kept my spirits up as I waffled forward week after week. My engineer, the dearest and courageous Tissy, was always there to support me, even as her cancer slowly took her life. She was a wonderful woman that I'll remember for the rest of my life. Fast forward to today, Erica Stimolo, my executive producer, Brian Zykowitz, our post-production engineer, and Carol Malzone, my editor, helping us put out over 940 programs week after week for 18 years. That's 18 years and counting. And I want to thank you all for your tremendous support throughout all of these years, and I'm looking forward to continuing this for the foreseeable future. Thank you. You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. I have been watching the ABC movie about Bernie Madoff this week, and it has brought back a surge of memories I thought I would share with you. The year was circa 2004 when I got a call from a client just dying to sign up with Madoff. My client had been talking with a friend who had already been in the Madoff Fund since its inception in the 60s and was arrogantly touting its many attributes. This friend had invested $2 to $3 million and also got many others to invest their money with Madoff. He thought he could convince Madoff to invest my client's money because he knew him personally and had an inside track. Rounding out the rest of the story, this friend had also involved the in-laws of my client's daughter, and those in-laws had invested all of their money, plus their entire company's bankroll, into the fund. So I had them both come in and bring the Madoff statements so I could take a look. The first batch of statements looked legitimate, like any other brokerage statement, but were missing some important details, so I asked if there were more. I was then handed a large bundle of printouts, which were printed from an old dot matrix printer. Many of you may remember them, some may not remember them, but those were the kinds of printers that had the type of paper with the holes on each side. And this printout contained all of the trades going back a number of years. So I thanked them, and over the following number of days, I studied it. And the information on these sheets raised a lot of questions. The first thing I noticed was that all of the trades were made at the middle of each month. Different dates of the month, but definitely clustered in the middle. Each trade contained a purchase of an index fund, which held the top 100 companies in the S&P 500. Alongside this purchase were purchases of puts and calls, which were there to either enhance the return or protect the money. But it didn't make sense. How could anyone know what particular day to buy and sell these investments to achieve a consistent monthly profit with an annual rate of return of 10%? There were only two explanations as far as I can see. The first explanation would have to mean that somehow Madoff knew when large institutions were actively in the market buying and selling. If Madoff placed his trades before placing theirs, he might be able to pull this off. Now, I knew Madoff's brokerage firm was a market maker, which is a firm that facilitates trading in a security and therefore does see the customer order flow. So bottom line, if he sees the order flow, he can get in front of it. There's only one problem with this. It's illegal. It's called front running, and it's against the law for any broker to put his trades ahead of a customer's order. Big red flag. The other explanation would be that it was all a fraud. Well, I couldn't wrap my head around this. Madoff's name had been around since I could remember, and there was never any negative news about him that I was aware of. The thought of a Ponzi scheme crossed my mind, but I couldn't believe that. Needless to say, I counseled against putting money with Madoff, And that turned out to be one of the best things I had ever done. Saving a client from disaster is a wonderful thing. What happened to the friend? Well, the friend had believed that he was now worth $26 million, according to my client, and had received his original investment back through monthly dividends. Of course, that was other people's money, really. So he ended up with nothing. The in-laws were wiped out along with so many others. So it brings some further thoughts and takeaways from this Madoff tragedy. In 2009 or 10, I interviewed Larry Lamer. He's a terrific author in Palm Beach who had written about Palm Beach society, and he mentioned that in Palm Beach, the Jewish community was very philanthropic. The season was filled with galas and balls, all centered around fundraising for worthy causes. He described a scene of the table talk of the guests at one of these charity events. You know, there are 8 to 10 sitting around a round table discussing this or that, maybe politics or business or recent car purchases or whatever. But inevitably, the conversation turned to money, and some bragging would then ensue. One guy would say, you know, my hedge fund manager was up 28% last year. And not to be outdone, another would say, well, you know, my money manager was up 34% last year. And so this discussion proceeded around the table. It came to one guy who said, well, my hedge fund manager is very conservative. He doesn't make these big returns. He just makes about 10% each year, year in and year out. Well, guess who his money manager was? Bernie Madoff, of course. So not only were those in small communities of Palm Beach hurt, but investors from all over the world were damaged. The many charities which depended on the largesse of giving people were hurt too, not to mention the people to whom they served. Pension plans also suffered. For example, a pension fund covering about 800 police, firefighters, and other employees in the Connecticut town of Fairfield had about $40 million out of a whole fund of $290 million managed by Madoff. Banks, insurance companies, foundations, colleges, and even celebrities all lost millions upon millions of dollars. The lesson and the sinister brilliance of this particular Ponzi scheme is that the investment returns being touted were not outlandish. You know, it's easy to see through a scam of someone offering a 20% return guaranteed. Just compare it to a real guaranteed return like the 10-year U.S. Treasury. For example, today that yield is under 2%, and that is a guaranteed yield for the next 10 years. Is it possible that anyone can offer a high rate substantially over what is essentially the real guaranteed rate of return? And the fact that it's guaranteed suggests that there's no risk? But Bernie wasn't offering an outlandish rate. The rate was not outlandish, but the consistency was. You cannot earn a 10% return every year. Your return can have an average rate of 10% for sure, which means in some years you're up and some years you're down. You know, simply said, maybe one year you're up 15%, one year you're up 5%, so the average is 10%. But to do 10% every year is mathematically really impossible in the markets. Bernie's other sinister trick was to create an air of exclusivity for those who were invested. They were members of a special club restricted to a chosen few. Anyone who belonged felt special and gave status to those who pretended to know Madoff or have some special pull. It's probably best to remember the words of Groucho Marx when he said, you know, I refuse to join any club that would have me as a member. I think we should all remember that. So goes this tragic saga of a man who destroyed the lives of so many, including his own family and closest friends, and he left behind a scorched earth which many will never fully recover. Bernie left no one untouched or unscathed who crossed his path. He is a true sociopath. You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. What does it take to create an iconic brand, and what family dynamics come into play once the brand is established and loved? Well, the story of the most iconic brand that has defined fashion for nearly a century is now told in a new book penned by the daughter of the great Aldo Gucci, the man who built Gucci into an icon. Patrizia Gucci joins me today from Geneva to talk about her new book, In the Name of Gucci, a Memoir. Hi, Patrizia. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Let's start a little bit at the beginning to give our listeners an idea of what life was like at the very beginning. Your grandfather, Guccio Gucci, started very humbly. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the first Gucci family business was manufacturing straw hats in the early 1900s. And that didn't go too well after a while, unfortunately. And he then had to go to the Savoy Hotel to basically find a job because the family wasn't able to continue the way they used to be. And that's when he got inspired watching the very wealthy arrive with all their incredible trunks and luggage and see all their fineries. And he got an incredible insight as to how, you know, the wealthy lived and all the beautiful things that were made in those days. And he decided to bring that back to Florence and start something of that nature himself. But he needed to learn a little bit more about the world of leather and the art of making luggage and trunks, which he did. He went to a school, and then he began the business in Florence in 1921 and opened a little boutique there and started with trunks. And from then on, it went on to accessories and handbags and everything else, but done with a little workshop where he had artisans put them together and in the way that only a Florentine would know how to do.
Right. I was recently in Florence, and I did notice the amount of leather sellers there and the great manufacturers that are there. And I can tell that there's a culture there of fine leather making. That was something that was quite obvious. And by the way, I visited the Gucci Museum while I was there.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. It is a great museum. I really enjoyed when I visited it. Mm-hmm. There's so much that reminds you of, you know, what Gucci's origins were all about. Definitely worth going to visit.
When Guccio Gucci opened his first store in 1921, your father, Aldo Gucci, was 14 years old. Tell us a little bit about Aldo Gucci, who really was the one who brought this brand into the modern era.
Well, he was an eager student of his father, and I believe the one who was most passionate about the company. So, you know, as a young man, you know, he basically wanted to know everything, how his father did what he did. And when he, you know, grew into a young man, he decided, look, Daddy, we need to move on from Florence, and I believe we should move to Rome. And that's where he set up a shop in. And my grandfather was very supportive at that moment of his venture to go to Rome, even though always very conservative and thought, you know, for him, Florence was good enough.
Yeah.
So they opened the first store in Rome in 1938. And then, of course, my father, you know, there was no stopping him. And the next big venture was to go to New York and London. And in 1953, you know, he came to New York and brought the phenomenon of the brand there because there was such an incredible recognition in Rome from Americans who would travel to Rome and after the war and celebrities that brought back all the bags to America. So he felt that he would want to be in America because that's where the big business could definitely develop. And that's what he did, against his father's wishes.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to understand the kind of man that Aldo Gucci was. He was a very much of a forward thinker. He was, in a sense, married to the business in the best way of saying that, and really was always thinking about how well beyond wherever the business was currently. And also he was very lucky in some cases as to where he chose his store locations. I know at the Via Tornabuoni and in Florence and other places right across the street from other places that turned out to be very lucky choices. How and why do you think he was able to get so much attention from the Italian movie stars and from Princess Grace? You have wonderful pictures in your book of her coming out of the store. What was special about the product back then?
Well, I don't think ever was down to luck how he chose his locations. I really did believe he had an incredible instinct. He would, you know, always walk everywhere and make sure he had a good understanding of the traffic and how the Gucci store could present itself. So always imagining the name. As far as the clientele, I mean, you know, Rome, Gucci was number one, and there was nothing like it as far as leather goods and beautiful handbags. And it was one of those places where everybody, word of mouth, you know, spread like wildfire amongst the elite and celebrities and royalty, and obviously having them wear the bags created this incredible advertising throughout, you know, through the photographers would be out paparazzi outside the shop. So Grace Kelly was an incredible, you know, wonderful client, and Jackie Onassis, all sorts of Audrey Hepburn. They definitely gave Gucci a great, you know, advertising for the brand.
My guest is Patricia Gucci. She is the author and the heir of the Gucci name. And the book is In the Name of Gucci, a memoir. There's also a story in the book about the creation of Family Crest, that it was understood that in order to be taken seriously, the humble beginnings of the original Gucci family really had to be downplayed, and they created a complete new backstory. Tell us about that.
Yes, they reinvented their history. Coming from Florence, which is very much a city full of aristocracy and the most noble, a lot of nobility, you know, Gucci had to sort of set itself apart, not just as a handbag and luggage shop, but they also wanted to give it the history so that people would feel they were wearing something from generations and generations. And of course, it was an invention. But my grandfather got inspired to create the crest from the image of a bellboy, and he put that on the crest, and that's how they created this brand in that way.
However, they did change it to a backstory that included possible ties to medieval nobility, right?
Well, the Gucci name does go back in medieval times from the town of San Miniato, and we have traced it back. But as far as nobility and aristocracy, I'm not sure if that's anything close to the truth. But definitely the name Gucci and the family traces itself back to the 1500s.
Don't forget to find out more about Patricia Gucci and more about her book. And to hear this interview again, join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Patricia, let's move forward now to the time when Aldo met your mother, Bruna. Bruna was hired by Aldo. And briefly take us through how they first really met and how their relationship developed.
Well, my mother went to work at Gucci when she was 18 in Rome and started as a shop girl and introduced to the manager by her fiancé, who knew him very well. And so it was a wonderful entrance into this world that she had never before seen, of luxury and glamour and something beyond her expectations. And she loved her job and was very happy. My father spotted her, of course. It was a small shop in those days. It wasn't a huge place like now. And she was a very beautiful woman and a young girl, actually, at those days. And you know, it was for the first year, it was all very proper, and he would just always give her special little acknowledgement that he would give only to her, but it was nothing untoward. And then later on, he asked her to be his secretary, and there he showed his true intentions a little more, and eventually got to a point where he decided to give her letters, because my mother was very modest, and she absolutely made sure that she was, you know, never given any indication of interest, but he was a formidable person, much older and powerful, and it was her boss, and eventually his beautiful love letters won her over.
Those love letters are printed, a number of them are printed in the book, and he was really quite a formidable writer, and he was truly enamored and in love with her, but he was married at the time.
Yes, that was the unpleasant aspect of everything, because in those days also having an extramarital affair was considered a criminal act, not just a moral negative act. And therefore, my mother, you know, was torn in being in this situation. And my father, though, you know, always reassured her that she was everything to him and she had to have faith in the process. But that was easier said than done for my mother. She absolutely could not accept being in the circumstances. And so there was a battle of that for my mother all her life. She suffered a lot of anxiety due to it. It set a tone in her life that made her, you know, maybe not the person she would have become if she hadn't been in that position. Yeah.
Well, Aldo also had three sons, correct?
Yes, exactly. Around my mother's age.
Yeah, so that created quite a problem. And eventually, this affair came out to the family and created, you know, a lot of...
After my birth, it became knowledge.
Right.
When my mother had to have me in London and came back to Rome, and the word leaked out that my father had me and that he had given me his name. Yeah.
I mean, the climate back then was such that if there was adultery, if there was a birth out of marriage, I mean, even Ingmar Bergman, who had an affair when she was married, I mean, the U.S. Senate actually banned her from public appearances. That's how conservative the country was back then. And in Italy, especially, as you said, I mean, it was against the law. You could be imprisoned for being adultery.
And the Catholic Church was a huge part of the process,
Yeah.
Very, very shunned.
But it was a huge hypocrisy when you think about it, because everybody was fooling around and doing what they
absolutely.
Were doing.
Yeah. I mean, Italian men are known to be the biggest Casanovas.
Exactly.
And everyone had a mistress or so, but it's not that my mother was the first person that in his life out of his marriage, but definitely she was the one that he fell in love with on a level that he hadn't ever before.
My guest is Patricia Gucci. We will be back in a moment with the rest of this interview. A recession is inevitable. We know that, especially now with tariffs, the trade war, and the possibility of a looming war in the Middle East. So, do you wonder how it will affect your financial security when it eventually comes? This is exactly what I'll be speaking to you about at my next workshop. I'll show you how to calculate whether you'll be financially secure for the rest of your life and how to make the right decisions to get financially secure and stay there. We'll talk about where to get the income you need, especially in this low interest rate world, and I'll also talk about how to get an early read on the next recession and ways to make sure your portfolio is properly positioned. These are just a few of the topics I'll be discussing, and of course, as always, I'm there to answer any of your questions. So, join me Tuesday, October 15th at 10 a.m. at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. That's Tuesday, October 15th at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. Go to stevepomerantz.com to sign up. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I'm here with Patricia Gucci. The book is In the Name of Gucci. It's a memoir, and we're speaking about the house of Gucci, the business, and of course, Patricia's life. Welcome back to our show here, Patricia.
Hello, nice to be here.
So you grew up in this environment, and you spent most of your life in England, is that right?
I was born in London, and I was raised there until I was 9 years old.
Okay. Tell us about your life after nine.
At nine, actually, I was a very happy little child at going to English boarding school, and I didn't really know I had any other life until my mother one day decided to announce that I had three half-brothers, and then my father had a wife, and that we were moving to Rome, pretty much all in one conversation. So that was quite a revelation. I wasn't unhappy about having three half-brothers. I was not happy about leaving England.
How were you treated in London?
In England? I was in the country in those days. I mean, I loved it. I was English. I didn't speak Italian, so I was very much English. For me, it was my life. My friends were there, and everything I loved and cherished was in England.
When you moved
to Rome, it was a shock.
Yeah, so I'm sure it was. So were you accepted or rejected by the family?
Oh, absolutely accepted. I mean, you know, they embraced me, and my father was. After about a year that I moved to Rome, he organized an encounter with my brothers. And, you know, when we were all together in the room, it was all very cordial. And you know, one of them was even effusively affectionate. You know, he hugged me and called me his little sister. So at the beginning, I had no inclination at all that there would be any, you know, objection on their part, even though my mother was very cynical about it all.
My guest is Patricia Gucci. The name of the book is In the Name of Gucci, a memoir. And don't forget to hear this conversation again. Join us at stevepomerantz.com. Let's move forward here a little bit and talk about the business. Now, by the time you were 16 or 18, tell us the state of the Gucci business as you knew it.
Well, when I was 16, I was at boarding school in Switzerland, but I would occasionally fly to America on holidays. And my father started then introducing me to, you know, to social situations, like when he wasn't able to attend a function or a party or an event, he would have me represent him. I looked older than my age, and I had all the poise that him and the wherewithal, I think, that he felt I could do it. And therefore, that was my first realization of how incredibly important the name was in America. It was quite significant. And to have that name was also quite a, you know, it was an important thing to have,
sure.
But it was also quite overwhelming, you
yeah.
know, because people would look at you in a completely different way, and that, mm-hmm. that's not how I was raised in Europe. But it was great. It was Gucci was in its heyday. There was nothing more exciting than to be around those exciting times with so much success and recognition.
So now you have been introduced to Gucci. The family has moved from England to Rome. You've been well accepted. As you got older, you started to represent the company, as you mentioned. So how is the business doing at that time? What year are we talking about?
Well, when I left school, I moved to New York to study acting, and one thing led to another. My father brought me even more into the company, you know, not just as occasional ambassador, but also, you know, to work full time. And in those days, this was in the early 80s, and it was still a brand of huge significance and influence, and, you know, people loved Gucci. Everybody wore Gucci. It was mm-hmm. something, it was a uniform practically for every single person to have either a Gucci loafer or a Gucci bag. And it was, you know, an incredible company in those days, and it was a fun thing to be working, and there's nothing better, especially as it was a family company.
1953, Guccio Gucci dies. And your father wanted to change the business. He wanted to go public and distribute shares, but there was a lot of fighting about the future direction of the company. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I wouldn't say there was a huge problem. I think everybody knew what they wanted to do and where they would be. I mean, my uncle, Rodolfo, was a movie star, but it didn't work out in the long term. So he came back into the company, and his job was to pretty much manage the shop in Milano and you know, occasionally go to the factory in Florence. And my other uncle, Vasco, he was in charge of the Florentine factory. And my father was the man who just was the engine and mm-hmm. just went everywhere and expanded and expanded and expanded and did what he had to do, marketed the company in every way that only he knew how, because he was the only one with the vision.
However, Paolo and some others conspired to take the business from your father. Can you talk to us about that a little bit?
That, yes, well, that came late. That was my father's son.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eventually Vasco died, my father's brother, and it was just my father and Rodolfo. So the sons, you know, my father gave them shares so that they would feel part of the company, and because Rodolfo was giving a lot of pressure to my father about their presence in the company and to make them feel just as important and not just employees. But Paolo was always a bit of a rebel, and he wanted to do things his way. He was headstrong. He tended to go against the grain and wanted to do things that were not part of the company's vision. And my father got very upset with him, and they were always fighting. And Paolo, you know, did a lot of damage in the family environment.
Yeah, so it was a lot of intrigue in the way that Paolo tried to, and actually eventually did, wrench control of the company away from your father.
Well, he had the opportunity to go to my cousin, who at that time, his father had died, and he inherited this 50%. So by going to my cousin, he made a deal, said, look, I can give you my shares, but you can buy my shares, and then, you know, my father becomes a minority. And that was how he took control of the company. Well, not Paolo took the control of the company, but that it was taken away from my father.
Mm-hmm. Was it during this time that your father was contacted by the U.S. Internal Revenue Service?
Well, Paolo, again, went to the U.S. Internal Revenue Service mm-hmm. and gave them information that my father had been evading taxes. And at that time, my father had a green card, was a resident. So they started a full-force investigation, and my father ended up going to prison at 82.
Yeah, at 82. This must have been just an unbelievable, devastating blow for him.
It was the worst thing that could possibly happen to him, yes. It was one of the worst things, and that and the betrayal. I don't know which one could have been worse.
Well, thank you so much for sharing the Gucci story. The book is In the Name of Gucci, a memoir. Author is Patricia Gucci. And to hear this segment again and to find us on the web, go to stevepomerantz.com. Patricia, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You know, a lot of people are remodeling their homes rather than selling or buying a new home. So it brings this question up as to whether you can recoup, or to what amount can you recoup different projects that you may have.
Well, I always say when you remodel, do it for yourself. But keep in mind, one day you may want to resell it, so don't go, you know, way crazy on the deep end on what you do and make it so, I don't know, outright feel that it's not attractive to many people. But having said all of that, Steve, the average recoup is about 66%, I would say.
So for every dollar you spend, the average is 66 cents that you'll get back.
Correct. Now, of course, as time goes on, this would be, you know, relatively immediately. So if you were to enhance the kitchen and then put the house up for sale, that's what you're looking at. If you enhance the kitchen and then go to sell your house 10 years from now.
Okay.
You know. Yeah. So what does that look like? For example, people always ask, well, should I do this? Should I do that?
Mm-hmm.
If you were to change out a garage door, it's about 97%.
So garage doors, I always see that at the top of the list.
I know. Why? this must be an up north thing. I don't know.
Either they're very cheap, or you know what it is? It could be curb appeal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because
you know how important curb appeal is, right? So you got that ugly, scratched up wood. But anyway, everybody, replace your garage doors without worry.
Right, right.
Okay, go on.
All right. So manufactured stone veneer, 94%. Mid-range minor kitchen remodel, 80%.
What is mid-range price? 50?
Depends.
75?
I mean, what are they basing? Oh, so let's say the median price home we just read is like 256.
Yeah, so it can't be 50.
It would be 15, 20,000.
Yeah. Okay.
That would, I guess, would be wood deck additions. You know, that's not a big thing in South Florida.
No.
Yeah, a pool would be more.
Yeah. All right, move on.
Siding, replacement of your siding. That's a big thing up north in other parts of the country, 75%.
Okay.
Steel entry door replacements, 75%. Vinyl window replacements, 73%. Fiberglass grand.
Wait, stop. What is vinyl window?
I have no idea.
I'm going to look into that.
It's kind of like, I don't know, I'm thinking of the Three Little Pigs. The house made of straw, the house
vinyl?
Made of.
Was vinyl one of them?
No, well, you know, I mean, how good is vinyl
for a
window?
We've talked enough about that. Number eight, these are all really boring.
I know.
Okay, vinyl window, steel entry door. I guess if you're going to have a steel entry door, you're going to get 75% of your money back.
And wood window replacement. So all of these that they're showing, these are the top 10 projects. They're running anywhere from 70 to 95%.
Okay, I have a Florida question for
you.
Yay. Okay. And I know you have some experience in this. What about impact windows?
Oh, yes.
It's a big deal. So
huge deal.
Tell us what you know.
Okay, so impact windows and age of roofs are probably my two biggest issues. So for example, I had a gentleman who's got his house up for sale, is asking $1.4 million. Everybody coming through, it's a big house, like 5,000 square feet. Everybody's, oh, but it doesn't have impact windows. Well, the impact of that is probably, I don't know, we haven't priced it out, but I'm going to say it's a $100,000 investment.
Sure.
So the seller's like, okay, I'm getting tired of everybody telling me it needs this, it needs that. What if I go out and install impact windows? Why don't I spend the $100,000?
Yeah.
That's great. It'll make the house more attractive. But the real question is, if you spend that $100,000, are you going to be able to recoup that $100,000?
That is the $64,000 question.
Correct.
So, number one, if he's not getting any kind of action on the house because of this issue, then having impact windows will take away that obstruction.
That's an objection because there's other objections. The house needs to be updated. There are other objections.
Is it an excuse?
And here, you just said it, it is an excuse. At the end of the day, when you hear it needs this, it needs that, what it's really saying is your price too high. I don't see the value at the price that you are asking.
So under that scenario, the real scenario,
the moral to this story is, and I told him, just reduce the price of the house to where the market is. The market's not accepting our price.
Right. Okay.
Save the $100,000.
Okay. Well, that's good. So what have we learned from impact windows? First of all, if you've got 5,000 square feet, do you really want to put up corrugated sheet metal?
No. Over every plywood window? On the second floor?
Well, yeah. You know.
Huge sheets of over very large windows.
Well, you're hiring people to do this. And I will tell you, though, there is a downside to impact windows. Okay. So I've been down in Florida for a really long time. I've lived through a lot of hurricanes. And we used to have put the corrugated sheet metal up on there. And at one time, we used to tape our windows.
Tape,
we thought
that's
that
right,
was smart.
Duct tape.
That was really stupid, but we thought it was smart. Anyway, what was going on outside stayed outside because you couldn't see it. But with impact windows, you can see everything.
Flying by.
And you feel like it's the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah,
and you're Dorothy in the house.
It's kind of
terrible.
Cool.
No, it's terrible.
I enjoyed it, actually. But what people don't realize, these impact windows will crack, okay?
Under a certain, what do you mean they'll crack?
They will break. They won't.
If they're struck.
If they're
by
struck,
an object
you will
at
get,
a certain,
they will crack.
Yeah.
So now you have cracked windows that you have to replace. So you might be better off keeping your impact windows and accordion shutters.
Okay. Oh, gosh. No, yeah. Maybe since I don't like
just
watching it.
Just carry insurance.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So we only have a little bit of time left.
Sure.
But I do want to go through this one letter to Dear Anne. This is, Dear Anne, my seller and I had a falling out. Now, this is a broker writing to, I guess, a broker magazine or something. My seller and I had a falling out. He asked me to cancel our listing agreement, and at first I refused, but upon consideration, I told him that we would release him if he paid the cancellation fee. The seller said, absolutely not. He's not paying no fee. And so they're still in limbo as I write, as this broker says. Add to this, that a new broker was brought on board, and they actually took out the first broker's sign, put in the new, that started a fight. Now she's asking the question, the broker's asking the question, is this ethical with regards to how brokers are allowed to treat each other?
Yeah, no, wrong. We have to take a code of ethics, and this is like right at the top of the game here. First of all, the second broker needs to ask the seller, what kind of listing agreement do you have? Mm-hmm. So if it's an exclusive right to list, which most of them are, you can't just willy-nilly decide, oh, okay, you don't like your first broker, now I'm your broker. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
You need to make sure that, and for me, what I would is insist on seeing something in writing saying that they've been released. You're also protecting, you have an obligation to that seller too. You don't want to jeopardize that seller and put them in a situation now where the seller may owe two commissions because of your aggressiveness in insisting on going ahead and being the second broker, even though it hasn't been released from the first broker.
That makes sense.
As realtors, we need to follow our code of ethics and watch and protect the seller as well.
Now, I can understand the seller's point of view of not wanting to pay the cancellation fee because if you believe that the broker underperformed, then in a sense, you feel there's a breach of contract. But then the broker says, well, I put in this time, I've done the advertising and all of that, and so I need some compensation for that. So it can stand in limbo.
Right, until the listing expires. Now, what that seller should do is reach out to the broker, not the agent, but the broker, go above the agent, go to the broker and see what deal can be made. Honestly, if a seller doesn't want to work with me, I shake their hands, let's part as friends and let's go.
Yeah, because what's the point?
But that's a personal decision between the real estate brokerage.
Well,
and
that's why I have you on the show, Terry Story. Terry is with us every single week. She's a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. Nelson DeMille is the New York Times best-selling author of 20 novels, six of which were number one New York Times bestsellers. His novel, The General's Daughter, was made into a major motion picture starring John Travolta and Madeline Stowe and two others have been made into TV series starring Don Johnson and Aidan Quinn. Nelson DeMille is a combat decorated U.S. Army veteran. He lives in Long Island with his family. Nelson DeMille, it's really an honor. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve.
You know, before we get started, I just want to tell you a quick story about my own personal introduction to your books. My daughter is currently 28. She's healthy and everything is wonderful. But back a while ago when she was 5 years old, she contracted a disease and she spent about 2 years in the hospital, in and out of different hospitals and the like. And I remember asking a friend, hey, I need a book. It was early on in her treatment. Can he recommend something? And he gave me your book. And I want to publicly thank you for helping me through those challenging times. I've read them all.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we can all get lost in books. That's the magic of books.
It sure is. Hey, I want to talk about your latest book, The Cuban Affair. But before we do, I want to talk about the publishing industry and the business side of being an author. Your very first book was The Sniper in 1974. That was your first published book. Did you start out writing as a sideline, or was it a serious effort right off the bat?
Well, that's a good question. It was kind of a sideline. Those early books, and we like to forget about them, were all kind of paperback originals, and I think they sold for like $1.25 in those days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did not quit the day job. I was not making any money with these.
Yeah.
But in 1978, I got a break. I was introduced to a man named Bernie Geis, who had published Jacqueline Suzanne's Valley of the Dolls. And he had published some early William Peter Blatty books before The Exorcist. And he was kind of a mentor to young authors when I was young then.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me a fantastic advance of maybe $30,000, which was a lot of money in 1970s. And he had an idea for a book called By the Rivers of Babylon. And that was my first hardcover.
Yeah.
And that was a Book of the Month Club main selection, a Reader's Digest book, and sold in foreign translation rights. So yeah, I went from relative poverty to relative comfort.
Yeah, I want to find out about that. How did you meet Bernie Geis? How did you come together?
Yeah, that's a good question because, you know, I say to writers, aspiring writers, if you want to write, think about moving to New York. We know that you can do this from Dubuque, and we know that you can do it from any place in the country or in the world. But only because I lived in New York did I know people in the business. I didn't know many, but one leads to another, and I said I was doing this part-time, and somebody just introduced me to Bernie, and it's the cocktail party thing, and going to author events. You know, if you were a painter in the 1920s, you're going to live in Paris. And I always say to people, if you really want to be a writer, you're serious about novels, you need to live in New York because that's where you're going to find people who can help you. Now, a lot of this business is personal. It's a small business, not as big as people think it is. Publishing is kind of collegial.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the last businesses, I think, where it's not cutthroat. And people are looking to help. And, you know, a fortuitous break, but it would have happened anyway, one way or the other, because I was in that world as a paperback writer.
So getting in the world is incredibly important. Now, what did he do? Did he ask to see your work, or did he just talk to you about, I mean, how did he know that you had any talent?
Well, that was it. I had done these paperback originals, and somebody I know gave them to him, and he read them, and said, this man's got talent.
Yeah.
And he's wasting his time on paperback originals, and we're going to make him a star.
Yeah, so it changed your life. 1978, By the Rivers of Babylon was your first major novel, as you said. And how did your life change?
Well, my life changed by $400,000, actually.
Okay, that's one way. Yeah.
After taxes, which were very high in those days,
and
my agent, I did have an agent at that point, you know, but I was still very comfortable. It changed my life. The most important thing is that it allowed me the freedom to quit the day job and to concentrate on writing. I had to do that. That's why Bernie offered the advance. It was sort of, you know, patron of the arts, and I was able to live on that money while I wrote the book.
Did it change the way you wrote? I mean, you wrote these other six novels. These paperback novels, then you had this hit, and did something crystallize in your mind, oh, this is a formula that I need to continue, or was there any change there?
Well, you know, in the business, they talk about the second book syndrome, which is your first book, and this really was my first book in terms of hardcover and, you know, mass distribution. You get self-conscious a little bit, and you say, oh my God, you know, they paid me a fortune for this one. What do I do for my second act? And the second book syndrome is not a good thing. It's usually the writer becomes self-conscious, the writing starts to get stilted, and he's trying to be too literary. Mm-hmm. I just kind of took a deep breath and came up with an idea. The name of the book was Cathedral. It was about the Irish Republican Army taking over St. Patrick's Cathedral mm-hmm. and kidnapping the Cardinal on St. Patrick's Day during the parade, which is this huge event in New York City.
Yeah.
That was a great idea, and I'd approached it as though I was writing, you know, my first novel. Best way to avoid the second novel syndrome is make believe each one is your first, I guess.
Hmm. Well, I learned a lot about the inside of a church by reading that book.
Right.
All of the, you know, the different sections of the church, the apse and all of that. I didn't know any of that stuff. So I do remember that now that you mentioned that. So you wrote your second book, and did you have a main character at that point? Because I know that you've used four or more main characters during your career. I have questions about, you know, what makes you change a character and the like. But when did you first start to develop your first major character?
Well, you know, all my original books, and you're familiar with them, they're all standalones. I never meant to create a character, mm-hmm. A continuing series. I read the series, you know, other authors, and they're good, but this wasn't me. I wanted to do something different every time. But back in the, I guess it was early 90s, I wrote a book called Plum Island with a character named John Corey.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And that was a huge bestseller.
Yeah.
And this John Corey character is a very politically incorrect, crazy NYPD detective. And it was meant to be a standalone, and you read it, and you see that as a standalone.
Mm-hmm.
But the reader reaction was so incredible. Plus, it was like 16 weeks on a bestseller list. And my agent and my publisher urged me to do a second book, which was not really a sequel, per se,
mm-hmm.
but a book that's going to continue this character. So there are now 7 John Corey books. That's my main guy who pays the rent for me. But for this one, I didn't really want to continue with John Corey. I also switched publishers after 35 years.
Yeah.
Publisher wanted something new, which I thought was very brave of them because, you know, when they signed me on, I thought they were signing me on for John Corey, but actually they were signing me on for Nelson DeMille. So they said, forget John Corey,
mm-hmm.
and quite frankly, some of your continuing characters in your other series are getting a little on in years and
mm-hmm.
kind of ready for Social Security. Let's create a 35-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know a 35-year-old, but I figured, okay, I can do this, you know? So that's why I created this guy, Mac McCormick, for The Cuban Affair, my new book.
Yeah. I want to talk about The Cuban Affair, but I still have some more questions about the business end of things. By the way, I'm talking with Nelson DeMille. Nelson is a New York Times bestselling author of 20 novels, 6 New York Times bestsellers. Of those novels were bestsellers. Major motion pictures, TV series have been made out. He's a real legend. And you've been writing for 43 years now. At what point did you get an agent? And a lot of people say, you know, I need an agent in order to succeed. Which comes first, do you think?
Well, you do need an agent. There's no doubt about it. Well, if you don't have an agent, you have to have a good lawyer who understands. And there are literary lawyers out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to prove yourself. You know, when I started, it was an easier business. A lot of writers started with paperback originals. All writers now want to go right to hardcover, and publishers kind of okay with this. But I entered this business in the 70s when writing paperback originals was okay, an okay thing to do. You honed your craft.
Yeah.
And it was the paperback originals that came to the attention of an agent who in turn took me to Bernie Geis, who became my mentor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to get something published with your name on it. And no matter how you do that, there's a lot of ways to go about it. Once you're published, it's sort of like you've been knighted. Somebody has approved. A publisher has actually put time and effort and wasted a lot of trees and paper to get you between covers.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've done that once, then you at least have the doors open to you. And you know, if you have an agent, you're certainly golden because the publishers and the editors want to talk to agents and they want to talk to authors.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them.
Yeah. So when you finally get published, you exist.
Exactly. You're no longer
invisible.
Real person, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, so the publishing world has changed dramatically in these last 4 decades that you've been writing. You mentioned what it was like in the early years. Let's just come right to the present time. We've got ebooks, we've got self-publishing as a major category. If you were out there today with your first books, tell me what you think it would be like and what you might do with all your current experience in order to succeed.
That's something I think about myself, and I've kind of evolved with the business. I am, more than most authors I know, business savvy. And maybe because I, for a while, was a business major in college before I switched to liberal arts.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of understand how the business works now. And now when you write, and no matter how big an author you are, well, my new publisher, for instance, Lehman Schuster, asked me before we signed on, how is my social media? They want you to bring something to the table.
Yeah.
And what you got to bring to the table is not only a fan base, but a loyal fan base that follows you on Twitter or Facebook, Instagram, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that kind of in place when I went to the new publisher, and that was sweeten the deal.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be able to self-promote. In the old days, you just turned yourself over to the publisher, they send you out on book tour, and everything was in their hands. And now they're thrilled if you have your own publicist. And I sometimes hire a publicist for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's changed. There's a lot of competition out there for readers' time. There's TV, there's everything, there's internet. So the market has become more and more fragmented. In the old days, back in the 70s, when a book like The Godfather, I always use these three examples, The Godfather, The Exorcist, and Jaws. These books sold like 12, 14, 15 million paperbacks when paperbacks were big in those days. It was a common cultural experience for the country. Everybody read it. People will read the same book, you know, two or three times. But I mean, the book's got a pass-on factor. So if you say you sold 15 million, maybe 30 million Americans read it. The market is much more fragmented now, and you're trying to grab a piece of that market, and you want your fan base to be loyal. And so you know that you're in competition, and you've got to follow your fan base, but at the same time, don't try to chase your fans. They're going to have to chase you.
Yeah.
It's a much more complex arrangement than it had been in the 60s and 70s. And then, you know, with the rise of the big box bookstores, that helped everyone, but now you have Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy books online, and you can buy ebooks. So the thing has changed. We used to depend on walk-in traffic for the holiday season to sell books.
Mm-hmm.
Now with, you know, Amazon ebooks and also Amazon buying them online, physical books online, there are no real seasons anymore. That's changed a little bit too.
I wonder if you can have a situation where 15 million books are sold. You can have a tremendously successful book, but the industry is so fragmented that I wonder if you could even reach anywhere near that number.
Yeah, very few people do. I mean, Dan Brown did with the Da Vinci Code,
true.
And there have been a few others. And then, of course, you have J.K. Rowling's books, you know, the Harry Potter books.
Of course.
But they're exceptions now. And a lot of the books are the really huge bestsellers are children's books. That may be a common cultural experience for kids, but adults, no, not so much anymore.
Interesting. You know, you still write your books in longhand, right, on legal pads.
What's
up with that?
I can't type. I learned how to write with a pencil when I was in the second grade, and it worked.
I don't know. How much erasing do you do?
No erasing. Always just crossouts.
Cross out, yeah. Are you drawing arrows and things like that?
Yes, exactly. I draw arrows, and I do crossouts. I make marginal notes, all the things I can't do on a computer. I give it to my poor, long-suffering assistant, and she puts it into the computer, and then I can play with it on a computer. But I refuse to type a manuscript from beginning to end.
Let's talk about The Cuban Affair. So it obviously takes place in Cuba. You described the main character for a moment there. But you went over to Cuba to research this book and develop it. What did you find there that you didn't expect to find? And I know I read something where you said you didn't realize the sense of the place until you actually got back to the States and started writing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I had that kind of same experience in one of my earlier books that you may have read, The Charm School, which was set in the Soviet Union. I went to the Soviet Union in 87 at the time of Chernobyl, at the time of, high tension between the two countries. You know, I grew up in the Cold War era. I read every Cold War book probably known to man for fun, not for research.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I understood the Soviet Union and all that. When I got to Moscow, it just was totally different. And I had the same experience when I went to Havana. I mean, we all think we know Cuba. It's been in the news and so close to us physically that, you know, I know a lot of Cuban Americans here in New York, and I also know some in Miami. So you think, well, I know this place. But once you step into the country, the whole thing changes. And I'd written about a third of the book before I went. I had to go back. I had the same experience with the Charm School in the Soviet Union. I had to go back and really put the stuff in there that you can only get with boots on the ground. All the armchair research and the internet research and even interviewing Cuban Americans didn't give me that kind of sense of place that I found when I stepped into Havana. I stepped off the plane, to 90-degree heat in October, and I looked around me and I said, I don't know this place at all. And I think anybody who does that kind of field research will probably say the same thing.
Well, Nelson, we are unfortunately out of time. For my listeners, if you want to hear this interview again, and you want to get these and many more informative interviews straight to your inbox, don't forget to subscribe to our weekly update at stevepomerantz.com. We are, of course, as Nelson is on Twitter and all of the social media, come to stevepomerantz.com to hear this interview again. And actually, we have transcriptions of it and summaries as well. Nelson, I wish we had another 30 minutes, but I do appreciate you taking the time to tell us about your life. Thank you so much. Good luck with the book.
Thanks, Steve.
A recession is inevitable. We know that, especially now with tariffs, the trade war, and the possibility of a looming war in the Middle East. So, do you wonder how it will affect your financial security when it eventually comes? This is exactly what I'll be speaking to you about at my next workshop. I'll show you how to calculate whether you'll be financially secure for the rest of your life and how to make the right decisions to get financially secure and stay there. We'll talk about where to get the income you need, especially in this low interest rate world, and I'll also talk about how to get an early read on the next recession and ways to make sure your portfolio is properly positioned. These are just a few of the topics I'll be discussing, and of course, as always, I'm there to answer any of your questions. So, join me Tuesday, October 15th at 10 a.m. at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. That's Tuesday, October 15th at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. Go to stevepomerantz.com to sign up. That's stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by The Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which The Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.